meets me back in Manitoba many moons ago.
If only all my high school history classes started with that theme tune, I think I would have done a lot better. It's time for Abandoned Manitoba with Gordon Goldsborough from the Manitoba Historical Society. Good morning.
Good morning, Nadja.
So, Gordon, remind us of the clue that you left us with last week.
Well, I said we were going to visit a 150-year-old building that overlooked the Red River that combined two themes we've looked at before. Longtime listeners may recall that we talked about the former tuberculosis sanatorium at Ninette. And we've also talked about the Watkins building here in Winnipeg that was related to door-to-door sales. The site we're going to talk about didn't have these both things at the same time.
Okay.
But it did have tuberculosis treatment and door-to-door sales at various points in its history.
So what location are we talking about then?
We're talking about the rectory, in other words, the priest's residence for the St. Peter Dynevor Church.
Okay, tell me more about this rectory.
Of course, a rectory is where the priest lives, and this particular one was for the St. Peter Dynevor Church, which is located on the east side of the Red River, about 4 kilometers north of Selkirk. The church is magnificent. It's an old stone building. It was built using locally quarried limestone, a very, very substantial looking building. And it was primarily for the people who lived in that area from the Peguis Band. And of course, there's a noteworthy name in Manitoba's history. Chief Peguis was widely credited for having helped the Selkirk settlers when they first arrived here in Manitoba in 1812. And in fact, many people acknowledge that if it weren't for Peguis's help, the settlers probably wouldn't have survived. And so we could often think of Peguis as maybe a founder of Manitoba. Without him, the province we know today wouldn't have existed. Well, Peguis lived in this vicinity, and so he was actually one of the parishioners at St. Peter Dynevor Anglican Church. When a fellow named Abraham Cowley came to take over as the priest of the church, he initiated the construction of a building, a residence for himself. What has always struck me as kind of interesting is that his residence was on the other side of the river. So here's the church on the east side. His house is on the west side.
That's a little inconvenient.
Well, I thought so. And I asked somebody about this, and they said, well, you know, the fact is that the majority of his congregation lived on the west side. So I think it's simply that he wanted to live amongst his congregation. And what it meant, of course, is that then they had to have a means of crossing the river. Mm-hmm. So apparently the congregation and the municipality together funded a ferry that would transport people across, or in the later years, a rowboat that would paddle you across. So there was a bit of a logistic challenge.
Yeah, they made a day trip out of it. Going to church.
I guess you had to, yes.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Well, so this particular building that we're talking about, this rectory building, was constructed between 1862 and 1865. So I say it's just about 150 years old. So initially it was the residence for Reverend Cowley. When he died in 1887, he bequeathed the building, his residence, to the Anglican Church, who had operated the St. Peter Dynevor, on the condition that it be used as a hospital. Well, it took a few years, but in 1896, then, the Dynevor Indian Hospital, because, of course, his congregation was largely indigenous, it opened and it was operated by the Anglican Church for the benefit of the local indigenous people.
Okay.
And this hospital, I think, was used for a wide variety of things. You know, hospitals admit people with all kinds of ailments, but I think probably one of its major activities was in the treatment of tuberculosis. We've talked previously about tuberculosis and how at one time it was a very widespread affliction in the population. What people may not know is that the incidence of tuberculosis is far higher in the indigenous population. At various times, it's been as much as 30 times higher than in the population as a whole. Even today, we read about outbreaks of tuberculosis at various places in Manitoba and northern Canada. Well, so the hospital was a sort of a general hospital, but it gradually transformed. And in fact, in 1939, the federal government took over operation of the hospital from the Anglican Church and made it focused solely on the tuberculosis treatment. So it became essentially the Dynevor Tuberculosis Sanatorium. And it continued in that role until 1957 when it closed. And I'm not entirely sure why it closed. I mean, certainly the incidence of tuberculosis was not dramatically lower, especially in the indigenous population. But for whatever reason, it was closed and the building was then repossessed by the Anglican Church. And as far as I can tell, it sat vacant for a while. And in 1961, the building, this little rectory building, was leased to a group that had been operating a sort of a weekend school for boys in North Winnipeg. This group was affiliated with the St. John's Cathedral in North Winnipeg. It's just off of Main Street in the North End. So they called this the St. John's School for Boys. And I'd say initially it was a weekend school, and then in 1962 they opened a full-time residential school. It was intended primarily for discipline problems. You know, parents would have a son that maybe was giving them a little bit of trouble, and I think rather than try to straighten them out themselves, they thought, well, we'll send them to this school and let them do it. And the reason was that the school was run by a fellow named Ted Byfield, and he had fairly staunch conservative views that were expressed in the school's philosophy, which were based on hard physical labor and corporal punishment. In other words, this was a pretty tough school. In fact, one of its headmasters described this St. John's school as the toughest school in North America. You know, in the sense that the kids were pushed to extreme limits. They were, well, in fact, the thinking was that this extreme treatment would help to build character and courage. They had to do all of the janitorial work at the school. They had to prepare and serve the food for the school and for the kids and for the teachers. They had a farm associated with the school that would feed the kids and the teachers. They had to work on that farm. They had to raise sled dogs because part of the curriculum. They did snowshoeing in the wintertime. They did sled dogging in the wintertime. They had to raise the sled dogs and clean their kennels. And perhaps the one thing that I betcha a lot of Winnipeggers will remember is that the additional produce from the farm, they would sell door to door. So there's the door to door sales part that these kids, you know, I remember as a child, somebody would knock at the door and you'd go and there'd be this little shivering waif at the door offering to sell you some sausages or some ham or bacon or honey or chickens. And, you know, your heart would break. And so oftentimes you would buy the products simply because you felt sorry for this poor kid. Well, they did this to raise money for the school. These kids were from all strata of society. Okay. They came from all over Western Canada. Many of them, I think, were from the Winnipeg area. Mm-hmm. But there were some from rural Manitoba, as far north as Little Grand Rapids, Saskatchewan, Alberta, BC. You know, basically, even though it was affiliated with the Anglican Church, you didn't have to be an Anglican. You didn't have to be Indigenous. Just if your parents perceived that you were a bit of a problem, they would send you there and they would hopefully knock the sense into you. It was very much a sort of a tough love, you know, the idea of spare the rod, spoil the child, you know, that kind of thing. Well, the boys, in addition to having to work, they also had to do carpentry. So they built, in addition to the old rectory, they built a whole series of buildings, dormitories, dining halls, classrooms, a gymnasium, you know, the farm buildings. Well, in fact, when one of their teachers, the chaplain for the school, died, the boys actually dug his grave. So it was really the boys were expected to do everything at the school. And now the teachers weren't a lot different. I mean, they were held to a very high standard as well. I'm told that the teachers were paid $1 a day. That's it. That was their salary. And they lived in a communal accommodations, pretty much like the boys. So it was very Spartan. It was a very it was a tough climate in which to live. Well, inevitably, the enrollment waned into the 1980s. It had been as high as at one time about 120 boys. It had gone down to around 60 boys by the late 1980s. And then in January of 1990, there was some charges laid over sexual abuse that was alleged to have occurred by one of the staff members who had taught there off and on for over 20 years. And that was really incendiary. It was a public relations nightmare. So, in fact, in the aftermath of that, they basically changed the name of the school. They changed it from the St. John's School for Boys to the Rupertsland College. Mm-hmm. Part of the rationale for that was, I guess, a change of name might just change people's attitudes. But it was also because the mandate of the school also changed. It was no longer a school for boys. It was going to be a coeducational school. They were going to admit girls for the very first time.
Did it make a difference?
Well, no, unfortunately, because the changes were too little too late.
Okay.
By that time, I think the public relations debacle was too severe. And in fact, in June, just a few months after those charges were first levied, the school closed. They graduated 11 students from the school. It closed. Its entire board of directors resigned. And a receiver came in to start liquidating the school assets. So in fact, the organization that had run the school, something called the Company of the Cross, was unincorporated and later that year. So basically, the whole organization just disappeared mm-hmm. over the course of that year, 1990. The building sat empty again for a little while. In 1994, they became the home for something called the Selkirk Healing Center. What it was basically it was a nonprofit addictions treatment facility for indigenous youth. And the idea was that boys between the ages of 12 and 17 could come here for stays ranging from 90 to about 120 days. So it was seen as of a treatment facility as opposed to an educational facility. So there we have it, a little building north of Selkirk that has had this dramatic history throughout the last 150 or so years, starting with a residence for a priest, then later a hospital specializing in the treatment of tuberculosis, you know, a healing facility, then a very tough love school for boys, and then now again a treatment facility.
Absolutely. The pendulum swinging both ways very dramatically there.
Indeed it is.
Gordon, what have you got for us for next week?
Well, we're going to visit a very remarkable site northwest of Dauphin that is considered by heritage advocates to be among the most complete and perhaps the best preserved pioneer homestead, not in just Canada, but perhaps all of North America.
Well, that is impressive. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Talk to you next week.
No matter where I go, every time the wind blows, puts me back in Manitoba. Many moons.